This is Intercom Feedback Loop. I am your host, Chase Hendrickson, and welcome you to this Journal Club podcast series brought to you by Endocrine Society. Thanks for joining us as we explore an important article recently published in one of the Society's clinical journals. Welcome again to Endocrine Feedback Loop for our seventh episode. I want to start by thanking you, our listeners, for helping to select this month's article. The Endocrine Society solicited input from you all via a Twitter poll to help us decide what study to review from several in the JCENM and the JES and the report on the risk of inpatient hyponatremia 1 out. So we will do our usual deep dive into the methodology of this paper in addition to talking more about inpatient hyponatremia in general. Now I'll welcome in two excellent endocrinologists to this episode of Endocrine Feedback Loop. As a quick reminder, I am a general endocrinologist and one of the fellowship program directors at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. Our regular contributor today is Marc-André Cornier from the University of Colorado. His research expertise is in obesity, but we will be relying on his expertise as an educator today. He teaches extensively at the University of Colorado in addition to chairing the Clinical Endocrinology Update Committee for the Endocrine Society. Our guest expert for this episode is Joseph Verbalis from Georgetown University. He is one of, if not the, world's experts in hyponatremia. He has researched extensively in this area with numerous publications, including clinical guidelines on the management of hyponatremia. So we've got a great group together today for this discussion. And as with every episode, what we will talk about today will be our opinions only and not necessarily those of our respective institutions or of the Endocrine Society. Today's article is Risk of Adverse Clinical Outcomes in Hyponatremic Adult Patients Hospitalized for Acute Medical Conditions, a population-based cohort study. It was first published in the November print edition of the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism. The first authors are Alexander Kutz and Fahim Ebrahimi, both at the University Hospital Basel in Switzerland. And now, Mark will walk us through the introduction of the paper with Joe helping us along the way to better understand hyponatremia in general. So, Mark, I will let you take it from here.
Great. Thanks, Chase, and thanks for the introduction. So I think the overall idea behind this paper is that hyponatremia is associated with significant morbidity, mortality, yet the true impact of hyponatremia during hospitalizations hasn't really been very well studied. So Joe, let me ask you for a little overview about the potential clinical manifestations of hyponatremia.
Thanks, Mark, and Chase, thanks for the introduction. I would dispute the expert, though I would accept one of the world's experts. After all, if you study something for 30 years, you better know a little bit about it, so I feel qualified in that regard. The biggest factor determining the clinical symptomatology of hyponatremia always has been the chronicity of the hyponatremia. I mean, there is a big difference between presentation of acute hyponatremia because of the accompanying brain edema and chronic hyponatremia where the brain has had time to adapt to the hyponatremia. So with acute, we worry about significant changes in mental status, obtundation of the coma, seizure activity, and in the worst cases, that may be about to have herniation, some dyspnea, and breathing disorders. Whereas chronic patients almost never manifest those kind of symptoms. Those are one more of a broad range of neurological symptoms, many nonspecific like headache, to more specific ones like confusion and disorientation, sometimes unexplained nausea, though generally without vomiting, and more in outpatients than inpatients, gait instability with increased falls and fractures, which is a more recently recognized phenomenon. So that's part of the problem with hyponatremia. The symptom range is very broad. Very often, you don't know what the chronicity is. The patient doesn't know, the family doesn't know. And so you're left not knowing whether some symptoms are really symptoms of hyponatremia or associated with other comorbidities.
Thank you for that summary. There aren't any true randomized controlled trials in this area, so we're really dependent on more retrospective studies. And these studies have shown an association between hyponatremia and poor outcomes, but these studies were also associated with significant confounding, often had very different baseline characteristics. So Joe, can you summarize a little bit about the current literature in this area and why not having a randomized controlled trial really limits our understanding?
Well, the way I would first answer that is to explain what the confounds really are based upon. And they're based upon multiple factors. First, I think, is the very large number of disease states that are associated with hyponatremia. I mean, you know, when I write chapters for textbooks, typically the obligate table of causes of hyponatremia, you know, begins to spill over one page. It's that many. And so when you have that many different disease processes, it means that there are always, almost always, comorbidities that are going to influence both symptoms and potentially outcomes as well. Secondly, if you look at all the studies that have been done over the years, and there are many, they've used different inclusion criteria into their analysis. So I think one of the best recent meta-analyses was by Corona from Italy in 2013, who summarized the 81 studies that looked at mortality rates in inpatients. And it's interesting just to look at the entry criteria for how hyponatremia is defined. 70% said anything less than 135 or 136, depending upon the lab, but 20% only included less than 130, 10% included only less than 125. So you're dealing with different patient populations and different studies. And then thirdly, is the endpoints are frequently different. In this study, the study by Kutz that we're talking about, one of the endpoints was in-hospital mortality because they didn't have follow-up data on these patients. Whereas another countrywide registry from Denmark by Holland Bill in 2015 used 30-day and one-year mortality as criteria. So you did, you know, different endpoints, meaning that it's very tough to compare different studies. And fourthly, I would say that in all of these studies, there's a failure to consider the possibility of spontaneous correction of hyponatremia, which very often in inpatients is transient due to things like pulmonary infections, pneumonias, drugs like thiazides. In our hyponatremia registry, Greenberg 2014, 40% of patients who retrospectively analyzed received no treatment whatsoever for hyponatremia corrected to at least 5 millimoles per liter or greater. So all those confounds complicate both interpreting studies as well as comparing studies. But I would say that all studies that I'm aware of, both recent and past, have shown increased odds ratios for mortality, inpatient mortality, and hyponatremia, ranging more recently from 1.4 to 2.6, including this study. And even though trying to factor out comorbidities is always a problem, it is wrong to say that these studies did not take them into account. I mean, all of them used multivariate logistical regression analysis to try to control for comorbidities. So maybe not as sophisticated as propensity score matching, but they all did, and they all agree on increased mortality. And if you're worried about comorbidities influence the outcome, it's very interesting to look at this meta-analysis that I just mentioned from Corona, because what Corona did is he analyzed separately the studies with individual underlying comorbidities. So there was MI, there was congestive heart failure, cirrhosis, pulmonary infections, and then mixed cases. And for every single disease, the odds ratio for increased mortality was between 2.4 and 3.3. And finally, in a recent study from Sweden, Mannheim 2019, they did a further segregation of those patients in the study who had no identified comorbidities. Now, you one can never say they didn't have comorbidities, but no obvious ones. And their adjusted odds ratio for inpatient mortality was 6.7. So I would say, despite these confounds, and they certainly are there, all studies with varying degrees of controls have found increased mortality with hyponatremia across all disease states studied. So this paper by Kutz adds yet another, I don't want to say nail in that coffin. That's, you know, what we are dealing with morbidity, right? So I mean mortality, so we can say that. But this just further proves, I think, what we have believed for some time, but adds more definitive proof.
Yeah, as you mentioned, there are some studies that have used the propensity score matching as a way to get around this confounding, and there have been a couple of studies, but they have not addressed in-hospital mortality. So the overall aim of this study was to look at the healthcare burden of hyponatremia in adults hospitalized for acute medical conditions, and specifically to look at mortality using a population-based cohort and this propensity score matching. So I think we'll now turn it over to Chase to review the methods of this paper.
Thanks, Mark. And what we'll do, now we've got that nice overview of hyponatremia and have a fairly good understanding of the lay of the land of the literature to date, we're going to take a close look at the methodology of this paper. And before we get into this specific study, we're going to review a few things in general that'll help us understand the aspects of this paper's methods. And the first one is a quick overview of retrospective cohort studies. We've talked about this before, but what a cohort study is you have at least two groups, traditionally two groups of subjects, and one group have been exposed to something. And in this study, which we'll talk about shortly, it's going to be hyponatremia will be the exposure. And then you have another group that is unexposed. So in this study is going to be individuals who do not have hyponatremia. And then what makes it a cohort study is that after you have split these subjects into at least two groups, then you follow them over time. Cohort studies have to have a time component. Some of the outcomes that we're going to look at were actually obtained early on, but one of the key ones was something that required following over time. So I think it is appropriate for this to be described as a cohort study. And then what makes it a retrospective cohort study is that all of this data was obtained after all of the outcomes have occurred. And we'll see that this comes up, this is relevant because whenever they're retrospective cohort studies, you are very limited in what information you can collect and obtain because it has to be information that's out there already. When they're prospective cohort studies, you can be a bit more engaged in defining what information you want to collect. With retrospective, it's what you've got available, and that's almost always what you're stuck with. So, retrospective cohort study. And several times already, confounding has come up. And we've talked about confounding in previous episodes. And as just a quick overview, a confounder is a patient characteristic that is associated with what you as an investigator has labeled as the exposure of interest. But when it's a confounder, it's this other, this related patient characteristic that is actually driving or at least a major contributor to the outcome. And so then you can mistakenly attribute all or at least most of an outcome to your labeled exposure when it's really this associated factor, this confounder that's a big part of driving that outcome. And these are always an issue with observational studies. You can't get around it by nature. And the authors point out repeatedly, so we'll talk about it here, as a concern for confounding by indications. We haven't talked about it in particular in the past. So a quick word on confounding by indication. So what that is when there is a separate issue, in this case, it would be a comorbidity. Joe mentioned several important comorbidities. But when it would be a comorbidity that is causing both the exposure and the outcome. So to use an example that might be relevant here, if you had individuals with heart failure would potentially be something that is driving the exposure. So it's what's causing the hyponatremia, but it's also potentially causing the morbidity and mortality that is being studied and maybe doesn't have anything to do with the hyponatremia itself. So that's a confounding by indication, is that it's this other event that's causing both of these things to happen. This is going to come up again. So we'll keep this in mind as we move forward, thinking about the possibility of confounders, specifically confounding by indication. And finally, the third thing that we want to think about before we jump into this paper is what's been mentioned already is propensity scores. This is how these authors deal with the issue of confounding. There are many different ways to deal with confounding, but what's done here is propensity scores, which has only been done a few times in looking at hyponatremia. And the way that a propensity score is it's something that's been around for a few decades, but recently has become more and more popular for use in observational studies. But in a propensity score, you take your exposed group, in this case, the hyponatremia folks, and you look at all of the associated factors that you have measured, all your potential confounders. You're looking at age and comorbidities and gender and many other things. And then you're looking at all those to try to understand how closely those factors are linked to an individual having hyponatremia. And that way, based on those strengths of association, you can then assign each individual in that group a score that relates how many of these factors, particularly the closely related ones, that they have. And it gives them a numerical value, a score. And then what you can do is you have your unexposed group, and often you have many more patients in that group. You can run the same analysis and give scores to all these other individuals. And so that way you can then match an individual who has hyponatremia, so in your exposed group, match them with somebody with a very close, if not identical, score, a propensity score with the group that does not have hyponatremia. With the idea being is that will help balance the confounders because those scores are the same. As always with confounding, the only way that your adjustments will work is if you have thought of all the important things, and then once you have thought of them, found a way to measure those. So we'll revisit any other potential things that may be needed to have been included in the study for the propensity score matching to work effectively. So now that we have laid that groundwork, we'll take a look at this particular investigation. So a few words on where these patients are coming from. So the investigators used a nationwide administrative claims database in Switzerland, and this was from 2012 to 2017. And the way this database works, this really effectively captures nearly all hospitalizations in Switzerland. And when they looked at this, they used both emergency and planned admissions to the hospital. They identified individuals who had been exposed to hyponatremia with ICD codes, and they looked at a couple different types. So one, a more general hypoosmolar hyponatremia, but then also a bit more specific, looked for the syndrome of inappropriate antidiuretic hormone, SIADH. And Joe, we wanted to get your thoughts here, as I know this is something that you think about a lot, have looked at a lot, and would be interested to hear your ideas about using ICD codes in general, because it's always a concern when we see studies that rely on ICD codes, but also in particular in this study when we use these codes to identify individuals with hyponatremia in the inpatient setting.
So Chase, obviously, that was a very nice summary of this paper. Obviously, ICD-9-10 codes are very useful in these kinds of analyses. I mean, in our own studies, looking at hyponatremia association with bone fractures, you know, a set of ICD-10 codes for fractures, I don't think you need any more than that. You either have a fracture or you don't have a fracture. It's not exactly a ambiguous type of characterization. However, when you're looking at hyponatremia, studies have clearly shown that hyponatremia is vastly undercoded by most treating physicians. And undercoded simply means that, you know, it's not a priority to code that as a characteristic of that patient. That probably has something to do with billing for different codes, but I think it's just that many physicians will view hyponatremia as something that's there, but not very important, not important enough to code. So I don't think that a really valid hyponatremia study can be done without using the actual serum sodium levels. And if you look at this study, their incidence or prevalence of hyponatremia in that large Swiss population was 2.2%. That is way under reported international studies of prevalence of hyponatremia in inpatients. They range from 38% in the study by Wald at St. Elizabeth's Hospital in Boston, but they used a criteria for hyponatremia of less than 138, to 28% in Singapore with less than 135. But I think the best comparator group, you know, we're talking about a small European country, which maybe codes better than we do in Western countries. but I'm pretty sure they're similar to Denmark in terms of how their physicians code. And in a similar study, registry study of Danish inpatients published by Holland Bill just a few years ago, again, 5 years, 300,000 acutely hospitalized patients, prevalence of admission hyponatremia is 15%. So I think that what the paper by Kutz is looking at is a subset of hyponatremic patients. And we don't know what that subset is because we don't know what the serum sodium levels of that group is. And there's a second reason why that's important. Several studies, but the best one is the study I mentioned by Wald from St. Elizabeth's in Boston, have shown that about half of hyponatremia of inpatients is community acquired, i.e. present on admission, and half is hospital acquired. We know that. We see our residents infusing too many fluids in patients who are sick and them getting hyponatremic. And the Wall study showed that not only is that about equally split, they showed that the outcomes, and specifically inpatient and 30-day mortality rates, were higher for hospital-acquired hyponatremia than community-acquired hyponatremia. So once you're using an ICD-910 code, you have no idea whether this was present on hyponatremia was present on admission, whether it developed in the hospital, how severe it was, all those things that I think are necessary for a really complete analysis of hyponatremia. So to me, it limits the applicability of this study. It does not change their results or the importance of their results. It just limits the applicability to even compare with other studies of hyponatremia, given the fact that they use the coding for identification of cases.
And we'll revisit this when we come to the discussion section, because the authors do have some of their own concerns about this possibility of underreporting that they point out as well. So we've looked at the inclusion criteria. We'll look at those who were excluded, so several different groups. So they did not look at non-medical admissions or admissions for psychiatric reasons or pediatric patients. Now, they also excluded a couple of other groups, one being individuals who were admitted to any special geriatric unit or patients admitted to the ICU who were not treated on the medical wards. And the reason that they wanted to do this is to achieve a higher specificity of the patient setting. So Joe, help us understand this part a little bit more, particularly with why the geriatric patients and the ICU patients might have been excluded in a study looking at inpatient hyponatremia.
Well, I think that relates to the desire of the authors to try to avoid some of the confounds that we've already discussed. So by focusing only on medical admissions, they felt that they could would be in a better position to analyze and have results specific to that patient group. Everyone knows that surgery patients are different from medical patients and that ICU patients are generally sicker. So the exclusion of ICU patients who were not subsequently treated on a medical floor is simply to try to better define the group that they're studying. Geriatric patients obviously are included in this study, but not those admitted to a specialized geriatrics unit. Where those units exist, they generally are a much sicker group of patients admitted to the geriatric specific units. They frequently have cognitive, if not motor defects. It's difficult to compare things like their length of stay or readmission rates to a more typical medical admission. So, you know, one can argue about or discuss the appropriateness of that, but I think it does fit with their goal to try to be very specific in the patient group that they are studying and providing results on.
The exposure, as we mentioned already, is hypoosmolar hyponatremia, and there were a variety of outcomes that these investigators looked at. So the primary outcome was a composite one, so it's got multiple things combined together. Two things in particular, one being all-cause in-hospital mortality, and the second being 30-day all-cause readmission. These two together make up the primary outcome that's being looked for. Several secondary outcomes that were of interest to the authors, one being ICU admission, a second intubation, a third was length of stay, and a fourth was disposition at discharge, meaning where was the patient discharged? Was it to home or some version of a rehab facility? The authors point out that from the beginning, they plan to do a subgroup analysis comparing SIADH versus non-SIADH causes of hyponatremia. And I mentioned that was one of the specific ICD codes that were being looked for. And so a good group of outcomes that are being evaluated here, and wanted to ask Mark and Joe, what other outcomes, if anything, might have been interesting in this study that we might have liked to know a little bit more about in these individuals?
Well, I'll start off. So I have a particular a strong feeling about focus on mortality. Obviously, if one is dealing with inpatients, mortality is a major factor that we need to consider, as are the other outcomes being considered. But, you know, after all, we're endocrinologists and not cardiologists. And I often use the example that we don't treat hypothyroidism so much to prevent mortality from those few cases of myxedema coma. We use it to improve the well-being and how well our patients feel. So I don't think it was in the purview of this study to look at that, because I don't think you can use ICD-9 codes or 10 codes to really assess improvement in anything from mental status to a sense of well-being. But that's one thing that I think should be looked at increasingly as an outcome with not only outpatient but inpatient studies, because it's what we really, I think, should be focusing on. If mortality is improved, that's great. But even if it's not, but our patients feel better and can function better, that's important. And the other thing is falls. We now know that falls from an unstable gait is a manifestation of hyponatremia. It turns out there is not really an ICD code for falls, because we've looked at that. So you have to look at other data. And again, I'm not sure it would have been possible within the scope of this study. But I think increasingly it should be looked at where studies have the ability to assess that as an outcome.
I think what Joe mentioned really nicely illustrates some limitations with retrospective cohort studies, because you're limited to what information's in the chart. You can do prospective studies, which are far more labor intensive, take much more time and along with that expense to do those studies. And in those situations, you can define what outcomes you want to look at and collect those prospectively. But just as Joe said, when they're retrospective, you are limited to what is available to you in the chart. And if it's not there, then it's just not information that you're going to be able to include in your study. And finally, on the methodology, a quick word on the stats. We talked about propensity score matching in general, and a word on how these authors did that. They elected to do a one-to-one matching. So for every patient with hyponatremia, they found an individual who did not have hyponatremia who had an identical or very similar propensity score. Sometimes you can do more than that, more matching with controls, but one-to-one is a very standard way of approaching this. Of one note of something else that the authors did is they looked for multiple outcomes here. And anytime you're looking for multiple outcomes, you will increase the likelihood that you will find an association that may just be by chance. That's not actually reflective of an underlying process. And this is just because of the multiple testing. And sometimes what authors will do, they will account for that. So they will adjust p-values to account for multiple testing. And it's not clear if that's a good approach in all situations. The authors here elected to not do that. So that does increase the risk of false positive results, a so-called type 1 error. Nothing that the authors did incorrect here, but something that we would need to pay attention to for that increased likelihood as we take a look at these results. I'm going to now turn it back over to Mark, and he's going to walk us through the results, and that we've laid the groundwork of how this study was done, what exactly they found as they report them in their results section. Mark?
All right. Well, if we start with figure one, which is the flow chart of included study patients, you see that there was almost 8.5 million potential hospitalizations that were available in the data set. And then they found over 2 million that were eligible. At the end of the day, they had over 47,000 patients identified with hyponatremia with a similar number of matched controls by propensity score matching. So these were, again, one-to-one matching. Look at the table one, which is the baseline characteristics. We see that these two groups, so the patients with hyponatremia and those who were matched without hyponatremia, were very similar across the board. The mean age was 72 and a half years of age. Most of these are home living individuals. Most of the hospitalizations were for your typical inpatient acute medical visits, so cardiovascular, oncologic, and pulmonary conditions really leading the way. And I think one thing of note is that this cohort was really primarily from tertiary care hospitals, which I think we have to take into consideration. So, I mean, I think there are a number of other potential confounders besides that that we can certainly discuss. Joe, do you have any thoughts on that?
No, I think, Mark, I think that's a fair summary of what the patient population was. The only thing that I would say with regard to the matching of the groups is, yes, you can see that in Table 1, the differences between those various comorbidities and reasons for admission were very well balanced between the hyponatremic, non-hyponatremic groups, as was the Charlson comorbidity index at the end. One of the things that I'd point out, though, is that simply propensity score matching for some of these doesn't really take into account the severity of the comorbidity. And that's true in the calculation of the Charlson index as well. There are very few diseases in the comorbidity index that actually have any measure of the severity of the disease. You know, we wouldn't think of doing a diabetes study, which, you know, is your area, without, you know, comparing the hemoglobin A1Cs between the comparative groups, but you don't have that in this kind of matching. For hyponatremia specifically, heart failure is a problem, because if you just say heart failure, yes, no, then that's ignoring the fact that hyponatremia virtually never occurs until you get to New York Heart Association class 3-4 heart failure. And so, you know, if you're just comparing heart failure, and most of the patients in the match, the non-hyponatremic group had heart failure but mild, and those in the hyponatremic group had more severe heart failure, you know, this matching won't control for that. And, you know, that's a problem of all propensity score matching. It's not specific for this study. But I do have some concerns about that in terms of how well these populations were matched.
And that severity of disease, I think, would be a great example of confounding by indication. And the authors also mentioned a few other things. They said smoking specifically was something that they were not able to capture very well. And so they point that out as a potential confounder that they weren't able to factor in. You could think of a few other things as well, alcohol, potentially some specific medications. Joe earlier mentioned the potential for diuretics to have an impact here. So other things that you could potentially think of that aren't in here that might have an impact, again, with confounders, that you can only adjust for them if you both think of them and then find a way to measure those, to factor those into your regression or what other form of adjustment that you're using.
All right, well, let's look at the outcomes. So we'll start with the primary outcomes that are summarized in Table 2. And we see that the primary composite outcome of all-cause in-hospital mortality and 30-day readmission occurred in almost 18% of the hyponatremic patients and right at 17% in the controls. That gave us an odds ratio of 1.06, confidence intervals of 1.02 to 1.1 with a p-value of p.001. This was a relative difference of 6%, but only a 0.8% absolute difference.
Something I chime in there just as a word on the statistics. So they use an odds ratio here. And I think that's always worth pointing out when that happens. But almost always when we think about one group having so many times higher risk of something happening than another group, in our heads, it's really a relative risk is almost always how we process that. And the authors here had to use an odds ratio because of the logistic regression that was used. So that was appropriate to do that.
If we now turn to the secondary outcomes, again, still summarized in table two, see that there was no difference in hospital mortality when it was looked at independently. There were differences in terms of 30-day readmission. So hyponatremic patients had an increase by 7% in 30-day readmissions. They had a 43% increase in ICU admission. Intubations were increased by 19%. Length of stay of hospital stay was increased by 56%, and that was defined by hospital stay of greater than 6 days. And then finally, the discharge to a post-acute care facility was increased by 38%. They then took a look at the differences in patients with hyponatremia who were identified as having SIADH versus those without SIADH. And we see that those with SIADH were sicker, as defined by the Charlson comorbidity score of 2.4 versus 2.0. Interestingly, though, the SIADH patients had a decreased risk of in-hospital mortality compared to the matched controls, with an odds ratio of 0.67. And this is summarized in figure two on page six of the manuscript. They report out in the figure that there was a hazard ratio of 0.61. And that was shown in figure 3C.
So to me, it certainly seemed a very surprising finding here, and that's really not something that you would have anticipated. And we can talk about this more in the discussion, but that was something I had a hard time, was not anticipating at all. And Joe, I didn't know if you have any thoughts on what this is. We'll look at some of the things that the authors suggest because they bring that up in their discussion. But any initial thoughts on potential explanations for this surprising finding that SIADH actually has a much lower mortality in hospital than the match controls who did not have any form of hyponatremia?
So based on, Chase, based on my previous discussion about underrepresentation of hyponatremic patients, the same applies here. To me, this is hypothesis generating. It is by no means proof. And the reason for that is if you look at the patients coded for SIADH, and I would just parenthetically add that our field is moving away from using SIADH, and we are more using the abbreviation used in this paper of SIAD, center of inappropriate antidiuresis, because of multiple factors, but one of which is that many people with SIAD really don't have elevated vasopressin or now copeptin levels. And so we want to encompass all of them. And SIAD is going to be more appropriately descriptive. So for all the fellows and young listeners, start using SIAD and drop the H from the end. I particularly like that idea. In addition, I'm gonna editorialize a little bit here. Because frequently when you read the nephrology literature, when I review the nephrology literature, they talk about antidiuretic hormone. And you know, antidiuretic hormone, we know what it is, it's arginine vasopressin. So I try to encourage people to use AVP rather than ADH and SIAD rather than SIADH. But regardless, they reported about a 10% prevalence of SIAD by coding in their hypoosmolar hyponatremic patients. That is way below reported incidences and prevalences of SIAD, which in most studies is the majority of inpatient hyponatremic patients. So the fact that they are only reporting about 20% of what I would estimate are hyponatremic patients if serum sodiums were used, and that only 10%, right on 50% of those were coded as SID. I think, again, we're dealing with a subset that we have no idea who they are. And this is in the discussion. We can talk about it then. But, you know, they argue both that this group may be more severely hyponatremic, or that this group may be less severely hyponatremic to account for these differences. The fact is, without sodium levels, you can't tell in this type of study. So again, it's an interesting finding. It generates hypotheses that can be evaluated in the future, but I do not conclude at all at this point in time that I'm convinced that mortality really is less for patients with SID.
That's a great segue. So let's move on into the discussion now. And we'll first of all, take a look at some of the conclusions that the authors come to and some of their ideas, some of the potential underlying mechanisms that they propose. And then we'll give you some of our own thoughts as well. So first of all, what the authors say, as far as a general conclusion go, they say that hyponatremia in general is associated with a higher mortality readmission combination there, as well as higher ICU admission, intubation, prolonged length of stay, and discharge to a rehab facility. And then, as we mentioned before, also pointed out that SIAD is associated with a lower mortality. And they say that as they review the literature on this, is that in general, is that their primary outcome is largely compatible with what's seen in the existing literature. So a few words that they point out, things that are unanswered, questions that come up in part because of their study that we don't yet know, is really the big question is hyponatremia actually what is promoting increased mortality, or is it just a surrogate? And I think that it's an ongoing question. And the authors point out that really without having an RCT, which they mentioned that there is one currently underway that they are doing, but without an RCT, you really can't answer that question very well. So Joe, I thought I'd get your inputs on this as well. Is where are we at on that? Do we think, based on the data that's out there now, do we think it's hyponatremia that's the big driver, or is it just telling us that these folks are really sick and it's whatever that underlying disease process is that's driving the mortality and the readmission? And then do we think we're going to get a good answer to that question with an RCT, either the one that's mentioned or some other one in the future?
So Chase, I actually think I don't want to say simple, because nothing in this field is simple. I think there's a clear-cut answer that can be derived from this as well as preceding studies, that hyponatremia does both. Hyponatremia is a marker of adverse outcomes. That's, I think, clear from all the studies. And I think this study and others that have used different ways of controlling for confounders, i.e. by studying only one disease state rather than a series of different diagnoses, I think all of them would argue, provide strong evidence that to some degree, and that's the sticking point, we don't know to what degree, to some degree hyponatremia itself is causal in the adverse outcomes in hyponatremic patients. So, you know, you could say that, well, we don't really know the answer to that because we can't parse how much the hyponatremia is a surrogate for underlying disease, how much of it is an independent factor associated or causing adverse outcomes. But I think maybe this is premature because we're going to talk about that at the end in terms of clinical practice. So let's wait on that, what the implications of that are. But I think it's both. And I think that what this study, along with others, shows is that we need to pay more attention to hyponatremia, figuring out what's causing it. And if it is an underlying comorbidity, treat that. If it's not, then I would argue for treating the hyponatremia. The RCT currently underway by the same group from Switzerland is ambitious. Their goal is enrolling over 2,000 patients on clinicaltrials.org. It is the only ongoing study that is looking at this. So we will be looking for those results, which are projected sometime at the end of 2021. And, you know, the group is very good at running these studies. So I have no question it's going to be well run. And it is prospective. So those things that I mentioned about falls, fractures, et cetera, will be looked at prospectively. One of the problems with any study that is comparing treatment, in this case, a variety of treatments according to the European Hyponatremia Guideline Group, the control group is conventional therapy. And, you know, I already said that conventional therapy, including no therapy, leads to an increase in serum sodium in over 40% of patients. So their challenge with even this large a study is really looking not just at the conventional versus the treatment group, but looking at the actual change in serum sodium, regardless of which group it's in, to determine whether or not that factors into improved outcomes, or let's say decreased the incidence of adverse outcomes.
Now we're going to take a look at some of the authors' suggestions, their potential explanations for that unusual, that surprising finding of the subgroup of those with SIAD of having a lower mortality. So as Joe pointed out already, very likely this could be an issue, more a methodologic problem for underreporting or misattribution. But the authors, I think, did want to at least try to suggest some underlying pathophysiologic mechanisms that could explain that. So one, they suggested that it's possible that those with SIAD actually had more severe hyponatremia, and because of that, actually had their hyponatremia treated. They say that actually fits with some of the data that they saw, that group in particular had a higher ICU admission rate, and so could go along with more treatment for that group, and maybe that's why they had a lower mortality. They also, just like Joe pointed out, that it could be the opposite. It's possible that the SIAD group had less severe hyponatremia, and that's why their mortality was lower. And finally, somewhat novel suggestion is that maybe in the SIAD group is the hyponatremia that they had was a manifestation of a particularly good and appropriate stress response from the pituitary gland, with, in this situation, would be release of AVP. And so perhaps that's a good prognostic indicator that if your pituitary gland is responding to stress like that, that you're going to do better with whatever is causing you to be admitted to the hospital in the first place. So Joe, you've already given us some thoughts about methodologic concerns. What are your thoughts in particular about these specific underlying disease mechanisms as to how likely you think they might be to be the explanation here?
So I have, I cannot answer one or two. Again, it's speculation without the sodium levels, whether the SIAD group was had more severe hyponatremia, less severe hyponatremia. I think the Charlson index is not an indicator. That's just an indicator of the presence of comorbidities, not of how sick the patients are. The ICU admissions, yes, that does support that SIAD patients may have been more severely hyponatremic and therefore treated more aggressively than the non-SIAD patients. Again, without sodium levels and with this low an incidence or prevalence of SIAD, I think we just have to consider those as unknowns. However, I would strongly disagree with number three. And I would disagree with number three, and I would stress to our fellows and trainees that how important it is when reviewing a paper that you also look at both the citations that they provide as well as others to see if there's anything to back that up. Specifically, there's nothing in the literature to support the view that patients with SIAD have higher AVP levels than other causes of hyponatremia. And this was reported by one of the people in this group, Wepke Fensky, JCNM, 2009, copeptin, differential diagnosis of hyponatremia. No difference between copeptin levels between SIAD, diuretic-induced hyponatremia, and sodium depletion or hypovolemia. In fact, the highest AVP levels were those in hypovolemic patients, not in patients with SIAD. And with regard to whether higher AVP levels may in some way be protective, again, the same group, including the first author of the paper we're reviewing, Klitz, published in 2018, a study looking at copeptin levels in emergency room patients in Switzerland, France, and the United States, showing that copeptin levels were strongly associated with increased mortality, an odds ratio of 3.42 in emergency room patients. So That study would say the higher the copeptin, the higher the AVP, the worse the mortality. So, you know, it's an interesting hypothesis, but it's one that I don't think has any support in the existing literature. Of course, it can be looked at, and this group will, because in the RCT they're doing, they will be measuring copeptin levels again. And hopefully in this study, they will be using more rigorous criteria to identify patients with SIAD. So it remains to be proven, but I highly doubt the increased AVP secretion hypothesis.
And to wrap up the discussion here, the authors point out some of their own strengths and weaknesses. So as far as strengths go, they indicate that, as we saw from some of these numbers, a very large sample size, and also their weighted analysis that they did, a couple of strengths for their approach. Now, they point out some potential weaknesses. So we've talked about misclassification, is that the SIAD may not be appropriately captured with ICD codes. Also, the potential for underreporting, Joe mentioned already, but they report that this was captured 2.2% of the time, which from other studies we would expect several times higher of that for frequency of hyponatremia in the inpatient setting, and then unmeasured confounders as well, which is always an issue. And we've also discussed this already for this paper. And so since we've thought about those things, what I'd like us to do is take a step back and think about, as we usually do here, the potential for this changing our clinical practice. So thinking about this study, just both in general, the quality of this study, and then also if this needs to lead to how we change our practice. So first of all, just this study in general, Mark and Joe, what are you all's thoughts on just the quality of this? How well done was this as an individual paper?
So I'll start again. Again, I've mentioned my major criticism, which is reporting or under discovery of hyponatremic cases. And that being said, it clearly shows, in my opinion, support for existing previous studies that there is, well, they don't find an increase in incidence of inpatient mortality, but in their combined primary outcome, they do see a significant difference. So I think it does further support the importance of carefully looking at hyponatremia in patients in whom it's discovered, even those mild ranges from 130 to 134, which people generally ignore. There's usually a cause for it, and if you find a cause, at least you know what may be associated with it. And even if you don't, then it's a potential target for therapy.
Yeah, I agree. I think anything that raises this awareness, because as you can tell purely from the underreporting, if it's not being reported but a fraction of the time that it's occurring, I think that's a fairly good indicator that this is just not very high on people's radar. And anything that we can show with this observational data that, no, this really is a big deal, it's not something that can just be ignored and waved away as that's just some hyponatremia, is that this is consistently, and now we have yet another study that shows that, no, these big outcomes that we really, anybody's going to care about when you think about readmissions and mortality and how important that is for a variety of reasons, that it's driving these problems, and that this is yet another study that supports that impact there.
I would just be devil's advocate and say we already had the number of studies that have shown us this, so I don't know how much this adds to my practice, as, you know, if I put my inpatient consultation hat on and say, you know, doesn't necessarily help me, but it certainly emphasizes, as you said, that we need to have more awareness for potentially the general hospitalists, ICU teams, etc., about hyponatremia. So certainly from that perspective, it as Dr. Ferbala said at the beginning, a nail in the coffin that this is certainly a very, very strong association, if not anything, and that's an important outcome in of itself.
And I like, Mark, the way that you phrase that is our view as inpatient oh, consultants usually. So Joe thinks about this all the time. This is his career. For folks like Mark and me, the main time that we think about this is when we're on the inpatient consult service and get confronted with lots of hyponatremia cases. So Joe, why don't you help us think about this? So for folks who only think about it in that situation, how does this potentially change our practice? So is it going to change what we do right now, or do we need to wait until we get more information? For example, this RCT that's underway. Do we need to wait for that to come out before we change our approach, or should we, based on this, even now begin to alter how we approach these folks?
So I do that, Chase, by analogy. So did we really wait for the studies showing that microvascular disease and diabetes was directly associated in many cases with hemoglobin A1C? Or were we already believing that and treating diabetics more aggressively even before we had definitive proof? And I would say, yes, we were. At least most of us were, maybe not everyone. And the same is true here. Yes, we need to wait for a good RCT to really look at changes in outcomes with treatment. But I think we know enough already to say a few things. So number one, we know that hyponatremia, whether caused or not, is a marker of adverse outcomes. So it shouldn't be ignored, and you should always carefully look for a cause. Two, we know that it is, in most studies, associated with degree of hyponatremia. So the degree to which we should be aggressive about treating it, to me, depends on the sodium level itself. And so I do believe that there are adverse outcomes with mild hyponatremia between 130 and 134, but I don't aggressively treat those patients because I don't think we have the data to really support an aggressive treatment stance. But under 130, I think all those patients should have some form of treatment for their hyponatremia based on this and previous studies. So there are some things that I would temper my treatment recommendations until we have an RCT. Other things I would not, and I think we have enough information to already advocate for that. But again, as you say, I'm the one who's going to be doing that anyway. So the whole question is, will this change, along with previous studies, the approach to both diagnosis and treatment among the broader group of treating endocrinologists?
And with that, I would like to thank Mark Cornier and Joe Verbalis for joining me for this month's edition of Endocrine Feedback Loop. I hope you benefited from this as much as I did, and look forward to you all joining us for next month's episode. And now you're in the loop. This has been Endocrine Feedback Loop. Endocrine Feedback Loop is brought to you as a members-only benefit of Endocrine Society, with special production oversight by Maggie Graham.
Hello, I'm Aaron Lohr, host of the Endocrine News Podcast. In addition to bringing you the latest research breakthroughs and clinical advances from experts in the field, we talk about education, advocacy, career growth, and more from the endocrine perspective. From bench to bedside, from graduate school to practice, from the doctor's office to Capitol Hill, we talk about it all, and it's free to you. So go to www.endocrine.org/podcast or search for Endocrine News Podcast on Apple, Google, or wherever you get your podcasts.